Good morning.
Widespread, rapid and intensifying, a code red for humanity. Two climate change reports this week that would scare the living daylights out of you. So brace yourself, we're getting into it. We have no choice. First up, the UN report of the sixth Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Rising sea levels, rising global temperatures, a decrease in Arctic sea ice and a retreat of glaciers, all resulting in very severe weather events. Morning Ireland's Joan O'Sullivan put together just a few from this year alone.
Getting out any way they can. Residents of the island of Avia near Athens evacuated by ferry last night as wildfires burned around them.
We start with these catastrophic floods in Europe. The western German states of Rhineland-Palatinate and North Rhine-Westphalia have experienced their deadliest floods in living memory. At least 43 people have died. Heavy flooding has turned streets into raging torrents, and many rivers have burst their banks, sweeping away cars, sometimes buildings, and much else besides.
As the town of Greenville lay in ruins, the Dixie Fire kept roaring. This is what it looked like Thursday night on the road to Canyon Dam in the mountains of Northern California. Everything, trees, cars, homes, and more homes in flames.
Canadians seek out water and shade as the mercury hit an unprecedented 49.5 degrees Celsius in Lytton, British Columbia.
The biggest storm in decades has left a trail of destruction. In Mumbai on Monday, powerful winds and driving rain forced authorities to close the city's airport, a major hub for the country. For weather analysts, cyclones like this could become the new norm for the region.
And it's only August. Well, that is one way to sober us all up of a Saturday morning. On Monday, Inger Anderson, executive director at the UN Environment Programme who launched the report, spoke to Cormac on Drive Time.
An awful lot of people will say, look, we have heard this before and we have heard that we're not doing enough. But we have had droughts before. We have had heat waves before. We have had flooding before. So can you explain to people in simple language what will happen if we don't take the urgent action required?
Indeed. I mean, we've had these. It goes back to biblical times, right? But it is about the frequency and the intensity of these extremes. Yes, we've had extremes, by all means, from the beginning of time, but the frequency and intensity of heat waves, the frequency and intensity of extreme rainfall, the frequency and intensity of droughts, the frequency and intensity of storms and tropical cyclones and hurricanes and things of this nature. And then, of course, what we are seeing is a massive reduction in Arctic sea ice, in snow cover and in permafrost. And these are the things that we are seeing with our very eyes. Obviously, yes, we've had events of climatic catastrophe before, but it is that much greater frequency that we should be very concerned about.
And this point was reiterated on Morning Ireland by Dr. Michael Byrne, climate scientist at the University of St. Andrews, research fellow at the University of Oxford, and one of the contributing authors to the report.
So by that logic, we'll expect to see more of these events, more frequent heat waves, heavier rainfalls.
Absolutely. And some of those effects increase, how we say in the scientific community, non-linearly with climate change. So climate, we currently have about 1.1 degrees of global warming. And some of these effects, say, for example, heavy rainfall, is expected to increase even more rapidly than the global average temperature change. So this is absolutely going to be an increasing feature of our climate over the coming decades.
Now, if at this point you're putting your head in your hands going, we've just had a pandemic, which we may or may not be coming out of, sweet mother of the divine, do we have to? It appears we do, because it's coming right to our door. Because on Thursday, another report, this time focused on Ireland from the Environmental Protection Agency, Met Éireann and the Marine Institute. And its co-author, Dr. Ned Dwyer, joined Áine on Morning Ireland.
Well, the main findings, Áine, have been that the temperature across the country has increased by about a degree over the last 100 years, which is in line with what we're seeing globally. The rainfall amounts have increased by about 6% over the last few decades. And in fact, work done at Maynooth University showed that the rainfall in the period 2006 to 2015 was the wettest period since at least 1700, when they went back through all the records available. We're seeing more frequent extreme events like heat waves, and wet spells are lasting longer. And also sea level has risen by about 16 centimetres since the foundation of the state. So if my grandmother was standing on a point on the southeast coast 100 years ago, she would have been on dry land, whereas if I stood on that today, I'd have water way above my ankles.
Later, Philip spoke to John Hanley, climate scientist with Met Éireann, and Dr. Glenn Nolan, head of oceanographic and climate services at the Marine Institute. And John Hanley put these increases into context for us.
So the key message here is that it is indeed getting warmer. So Ireland is about 0.9 degrees Celsius warmer than it was in the pre-industrial period. And this is comparable to the change that we've seen globally. So the IPCC report reported earlier in the week that the global temperature increase has been about 1.1 degrees Celsius. So we're roughly in line with what we've seen there globally. It's important to note, so, you know, listeners may be thinking that sounds like quite a small change in terms of what we observe day to day. However, this is a massive and unprecedented shift in terms of climate. This is warmer than we've been for some time, likely more than 100,000 years. And also we see changes then in terms of our weather. So we'll see an increase in the intensity and the frequency of heat waves. So we experienced our heat wave recently a couple of weeks ago. We had two tropical nights in that heat wave, which is unprecedented here in Ireland. We had a record temperature in Northern Ireland. We're seeing events across the globe. As you mentioned, we're seeing record temperatures possibly being reached in Southern Europe. So we're seeing this play out in terms of our weather and weather extremes on a day-to-day basis at this stage, yes.
Ooh, so what do we need to do, particularly at governmental level? Well, former IPCC lead author and emeritus professor at Maynooth University, John Sweeney, joined Paul Cunningham on Monday's News at One.
What is the acid test for you which would make you believe that the government was serious, the Irish government, in trying to ensure that it takes actions against climate change which are in line with what is being warned by the IPCC today?
I think the acid test is an annual test of whether or not departments, whether or not government departments and sectors are delivering on the promises they made, and that those promises are severe enough over the next 5 years to provide a convincing argument that we're serious about tackling climate change, and also to provide evidence that we're serious about absolute reductions, not simply trying to buy our way out of the problem by buying credits elsewhere, or simply trying to fudge the issues by offsets and rather dubious elements of reductions. I think that would be ultimately to the detriment of the whole of the country and also the whole of humanity, because let's remember, Ireland emits more greenhouse gases than the 300 million poorest people in the world. So our actions have consequences for the farmers in Malawi, for the farmers in Zambia, and we can't run away from those.
And while individual responsibility is important, vital even, reduce, reuse, recycle, we know the drill. When Michael Mann, professor and director at the Earth Systems Science Centre at Pennsylvania State University, spoke to Philip, he gave this very interesting insight into corporate responsibility.
This idea that it's about individual behavioural change, that's very convenient for polluters to make it about you or me rather than about, you know, the fossil fuels. You know, 70% of the carbon emissions come from just 100 polluters. And so, you know, when BP in the early 2000s actually gave us the very first individual carbon footprint calculator, so each of us could calculate our own individual carbon footprint, BP wanted us so focused on our own individual carbon footprint that we didn't notice theirs, that we didn't notice the overwhelming carbon footprint of just a relatively small number of polluting companies, fossil fuel companies. So yes, that has been a problem. We've seen it in other domains. The beverage industry used this sort of deflection campaign in the 1970s to prevent the passage of bottle bills here in the United States. And instead, they ran commercials showing people picking up their bottle and can litter. It's just about individual behavior because they didn't want bottle bills. They didn't want a systemic solution that would solve the problem, but it would hurt their profits.
And this kind of individual thinking has led to journalists making those stories personal, which is both good, we need to change, and bad, it's just not enough.
There's been sort of an overemphasis of how you can change your diet, how you can change your transportation, how you can, you know, have less children, all of these things that individuals supposedly need to do. And one final point here. Of course, we should all do those things. We should be, you know, the best stewards of this planet that we can be. We should seek to, to minimize our environmental impact and our carbon footprint. But we can't allow polluters to pretend that that somehow is going to solve this problem in the absence of systemic policies, carbon pricing, subsidies for renewable energy, blocking new fossil fuel infrastructure, all of these things that you and I can't do ourselves but need to happen.
And one question seemed to crop up again and again. Were these sustainability goals compatible with capitalism in the 21st century? Back to the UN's Inger Andersen on Drive Time.
We had left-leaning politicians in Ireland say there can be no more millionaires, no more billionaires. The activity upon which this climate destruction is rooted is capitalist in nature. It's this political ideology that drives production, that drives the burning of fossil fuels to keep whatever operation you run competitive. Is there any validity to that viewpoint?
Well, I haven't seen the paper, so I won't comment in Ireland that you refer to. But what I will say is that SDG 12, this speaks to sustainable consumption and production, that we should, by 2020, reach for sustainable consumption and production. You can turn that on its head and say unsustainable consumption and production, that runaway consumption and production, the throwaway culture, the lack of circularity in our economy, the fact that we are not recycling or even designing for reuse and upcycling, all of that is eroding the very basis, not just on the climate side, but obviously also on biodiversity and on pollution side. So the ideas of the Sustainable Development Goals, and now I refer to SDG 12, sustainable consumption and production, is, if you like, the underpinning of long-term sustainability for our societies, yes.
Oh, it seems an enormous task ahead of us, but can we turn it around? Here's former President Mary Robinson and member of the Elders and founder of the Mary Robinson Foundation on Climate Justice. And she spoke to Katrina Perry on Tuesday's Morning Ireland.
It's time for action, but the good news, and it is good news, is the scientists are telling us quite clearly that this is doable. And we have every reason to do it, because look at what's happening around the world. And it will get worse and worse unless we face up to this. So it's a kind of, it's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity. It really is. Try and think ahead, 25 years ahead or 20 years ahead. What will people say then if we haven't done what we need to do now? Every centimetre matters in climate. You know, going up, we're almost at one point, we're over 1.1. We must stay below 1.2 as long as possible, fight not to go up to 1.3 and definitely try to stay below 1.5. And if we go up temporarily, which people feel we might, we know we can come down by having the biodiversity, by cutting out fossil fuel. We must imagine this world that we need to be hurrying towards, because it's going to be a very good world. It's going to be a world where it'll be like at the beginning of COVID, when we had the fresh air and we heard the birds. It's going to be much, much healthier because we won't have the asthma and the deaths from pollution of fossil fuel, indoor and outdoor pollution. And it's going to be a much fairer world because, as I said, the developing countries will have access to electricity and they will be competing. But it'll be in a world where we'll all hopefully have slow food, slow fashion. We won't be over-consuming, over-producing, but we'll be perfectly happy.
Last word on this to Greta Thunberg.
This report doesn't tell us what to do. It doesn't say you have to do this and then you have to do this. It doesn't provide us with such solutions or tell us that you need to do this. And that's up for us. We are the ones who need to take the decisions, and we are the ones who need to be brave and ask the difficult questions to ourselves, like what do we value? Are we ready to take action to ensure future and present living conditions? So I hope that this can be a wake-up call and that it really gives perspective.
All eyes now on the COP26 UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow this November. The other story that gathered momentum as the week progressed was the US withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. And then, city after city falling to the Taliban at a pace that was very fast and very frightening. Mahbuba Siraj is the founder of the Afghan Women's Network. She's in Kabul and she believes she's on a Taliban death list. She spoke to Anya on Morning Ireland yesterday.
The return of the Taliban, what it means for women, is that, first of all, they're going to kill whatever voice or destroy whatever, any voices that they are out there. They're going to quiet those voices in one way or another. Those voices are going to be quieted, maybe mine and quite a lot of others. And once the voices are quieted, voices that do speak, the rest of it is easy. The rest of it, the fear will take over. And the fear will do the rest of the job. And all of these women, they are in danger anyways. So they have to leave. But right now, the whole situation, the way it is, it's like such a fear right now that, you know, that everything, the way it's working, we are losing it. And I don't understand it, because you know these women, they have to get out of the country, most of them, especially the ones that they were at the forefront. How are they going to leave? There no embassy around the countries that they are our neighbors. None of them gives us visas. None of them.
And while the US and other countries evacuate civilians from their embassies, what can the international community do? Is there anything that anyone can do to help people like you and all those women who fear what's ahead of them now and the weeks ahead?
Please, you know, for the international community, anybody that has a, you know, this whole thing was so badly thought, was so badly planned, was so badly executed that I cannot tell you. Was so wrong from the point one all the way until God knows where it's going to get, because this is not the end. I mean, the world hasn't even seen the end yet. The world hasn't even seen the middle of it yet. The world hasn't seen anything, but they are going to. They are going to, really. And when they do, I have no idea how they are going to justify it and what they are going to say.
Mahbuba Siraj of the Afghan Women's Network speaking from Kabul to Morning Ireland yesterday. Back in a bit. Welcome back.
In red. She's done it!
Yes.
Olympic champion Kelly Harrington! Goal for Harrington! Goal for the darling of Dublin! What an incredible moment! Michael Carruth, Katie Taylor, and now Kelly Harrington, Olympic champion.
Sunday was Kelly Day, as was Monday and Tuesday. Frankly, the whole week long, we were coming down with the Harrington. Because if ever there was a gold medal winner who seemed admirable on all kinds of levels, Kelly Harrington was it. Monday's Liveline brought us this.
Golden Hero, Earl Kelly, Kelly Vision Song Contest. We are going to do what we do very well in Ireland, and that is on today's Liveline, we want to celebrate in song, story, ballad and poem the incredible victory at this incredible time for this incredible woman, Kelly Harrington.
And when Kelly comes home with the boxing gold, we'll be there, and when Kelly comes home with the boxing gold, we'll be there.
In her eyes, we can see the future. She's just magic, a father's voice whispered proudly. In mind and spirit, we stand steadfast with her on that podium in Tokyo, knowing that she did it for us.
From Portland Road to Tokyo, we followed her with pride. Did she know that everyone back home was standing by her side?
She worked her way up in the ranks of the best. St. Mary's Boxing Club Tala. Great thanks is expressed for this young teenage girl who sought a good path, found love in your sport, and good life has since had.
The venue more square than ring. My God, did Portland Row sing. Vrodak Osgwelga is pride. It looked like you took it in your stride. A winner, you took Olympic gold, a family tale for generations to be told. The anthem brought tears to your eyes. A hero, our champ, Ireland cries.
Honest, humble, a timid tiger in Tokyo's raring to roll. Arises from shadows of boxing, helps a nation to soar. Country awakens amid mild, misty Irish August morn. Beholds a battling beauty as sheer brilliance is born.
We're all delighted with Kelly. We saw her on the telly. When she became the Olympic champion, our Kelly Harrington. Our Kelly Harrington.
Let's dance.
La 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 la.
Champion stuff, and that was only the start of it. But back to the fight and the win. Fresh from the ring, Dervin MacDonald in for Brendan on Sunday spoke to Kelly.
Do you realise, Kelly Harrington, what you have done for the country today?
I don't really, it hasn't sunk in, but I've just seen some clips there of a home of Portland Row and Dublin One, and I've just seen so many people out and I've just seen so many smiles, to see so many people smiling and just being happy. It's just, that's just an amazing feeling to be able to make so many people smile and give people something to be cheering and happy for.
There have been so many tears, Kelly, happy tears, just looking at you as Aron Navain was played, watching you put your hand to your heart. You seemed just genuinely overwhelmed at that moment.
I'm on the biggest stage that I've ever been on in my life, and there's not many people who get to stand on that stage, and I'm watching my flag go up, my country's flag go up and my national anthem playing. There's not many countries who get that, and I'm just so happy and honoured and relieved also, mostly relieved to be honest with you. Because of all the hard work, and it is tough. It's very, very tough and exhausting. And just to be able to show that I work so hard, and this is why I work so hard. It's just amazing.
Oh, there were tears of joy and relief all over the radio, snot-covered radio, because when it came to Olympians, Kelly was very special. And when Ryan spoke to Kelly's partner, Mandy Loughnan, well, more love on the airwaves. But their get-together wasn't exactly love at first sight.
How did you guys meet?
We met about 13 years ago boxing. And she used to have to trek over to Bray to train, where I was training at the time. And we just met there and clicked. And the rest is history.
And the rest, as they say, is history. Yeah. Because Kelly was saying in a previous interview that when she met you, she didn't really like you because she called you cocky, and that she was from town and you were from Fox Rock, and that this was never going to work.
I must have been very intimidating.
I wouldn't have thought you were intimidating, but was there an initial sort of maybe a vibe that maybe you weren't going to be best friends?
I think it was just a very initial meeting, maybe the first time. After that, everything was grand, I suppose it's just such a difference. Sometimes the north inner city girl and a south side girl might just not get on straight away, but opposites obviously attract, and it was the best thing ever.
And they have two doggies.
We have a little French bulldog, Nidge, and he's 3, and we have a Staffy, Macy, and she's 12, and they're just... they're just gorgeous.
There's no messing. They're serious dogs now you have.
Oh my God, no, they're so not. They're absolute babies. They do not know their dog, Brian. They think they're human.
And is Nidge named after, I presume, love hate, our friend?
Absolutely, yeah. It's a love hate relationship. You love to hate him and you hate to love him.
And how will they both unwind after all of this excitement?
What's the crack for the next 24 hours then, in terms of Kelly coming home and you guys getting time together and trying to readjust to this new reality?
I have no idea. Time together, I can't see that happening.
Not for today or tomorrow.
The rest of the country now,
Yeah, that's it for sure.
So we're just ready to go with the flow and do whatever Kelly wants to do. And hopefully we can get her to relax a little bit and just unwind a little bit now. And it's going to take a toll on her now for the next while, just to catch up on sleep and all that kind of crack.
Yeah, like anyone.
And everybody else around her.
Exactly. And then hopefully again the dust settles, because after something as enormous as this, she will need to be minded and looked after, as you know what I mean. And plenty of what do you guys like to eat together when you're watching TV and stuff? Coffee slices.
Oh yeah. Well, Kelly would be partial to the coffee slices. Yeah, absolutely.
We've got to get some coffee slices out to the house
and a fancy coffee. Yeah,
coffee slices, eh? But not yet, because first Kelly had to arrive home, and Portland Row was on fire, as was Drive Time's own pugilist Barry, the breathless Lenehan.
The hoolie to end all hoolies. I'm talking to you from the middle of Portland Row, just beside Kelly Harrington's house and the Corinthians Boxing Club. And as you can hear in the background, here is the moment the people of Portland Row have been waiting for all the last few weeks. And as they sing Olé Olé, let me give you a second of the atmosphere here. The songs have been going on from very early. Lots of people, they're wearing the tricolours around them. One man from Gardner Street has dressed up as St. Patrick, while even people young and old, they have miniature gold medals around their neck, while even the dogs of Portland Row have gold medals around their neck for this very special moment. As we can see now, Kelly is just right in front of me. She's on the bus with her father, Christy Senior, her mother, Yvonne, her brothers, Joel and Christy Junior, and as well as Michael Dara McCauley, the Dublin All-Ireland winning footballer and community worker here in the area. And Kelly looks so delighted. There's a fist pump from Kelly Harrington with the gold medal around her neck and waving to the adoring crowds here in Portland Row. She's gripping a tricolour, the gold balloons are going in the air, and there's a piece of gold carpet right across from her house here at the bottom of Portland Row.
Gold carpet. Yes, worthy of reverb. Fantastic stuff. But what of the woman herself? Well, earlier Brian O'Connell spoke to Kelly when the plane landed.
Welcome home. I think you said it wouldn't really sink in until you got back on Irish soil. Has it sunk in?
Hasn't really sunk in, to be honest with you. Like, I'm just very grounded. Like, it's just, like, yeah, hasn't sunk in. Like, normally I'm bawling my eyes out, but I am absolutely exhausted. I haven't slept since the weigh-in, like, the morning of the fight. I've had it, like, on and off on the plane, so I'm quite, like, I feel like death warmed up, probably.
And what was it like meeting your family?
Brilliant to see them all. Like, they're all bawling their eyes out, you know, like, because they know, they've know what I've done to get here, like, and what I've sacrificed, and the highs and the lows and the journey. And it's, no one's journey is easy, you know. It's not just my, like, I don't want to say my journey is this and that, but nobody's journey is easy. But they know what my journey was, you know, and for them to see me reaping the rewards of my hard work and of my determination and willpower of not giving up when many other people would have, for them to see that today, that's, you know, it's special.
What a winner. Kelly Harrington, Olympic gold medalist. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, climate change and Kelly took up a lot of the radio this week, deservedly so on both counts. But there was more, much more. So put on your running shoes to keep up. And we'll start with this from John Zorn, as heard in Blue of the Night. Now we're at it. Okay, Ryan, back from holidays, not a fan of the heat, not one little bit.
I couldn't do 7 degrees. I was on Inishbofin when that beautiful sun hit, and it was me and the gang, young people were all hanging around, and they were all about to get into the sea and everything, and I was there, trousers, shirt, shoes, everything. I just can't. I'm scarred from a childhood sunburn. Can't do proper sun. Had a book. Eventually put the book on my face just to stop the sun from trying to penetrate my eyes. And of course that was filmed. Then I became a TikTok. Then I became a laughingstock. But I did look like basically Patrick Kavanagh on tour.
Quite the image. The Olympics is over. We cheered. But was it enough to wrest the remote control from our pudgy little fat fingers? Unlikely, says psychologist Dr. Anne-Marie Craven.
Does the Olympics lead to a spike in people taking up sports, Anne-Marie, or is it just for the 2 weeks in the back garden?
Well, that's a good question. So I'd love to say it does, but actually a paper has come out in The Lancet, so all credit to Niamh Murphy and Waterford IT here, one of the co-authors. But this paper has found probably not. So the Olympics probably doesn't lead to a spike. So, for example, after London, there were more Google searches for exercise, but no evidence that more people were exercising. Yeah. And actually after Sydney, men tended to report that they intended to be more active. They had good intentions, but that didn't translate into physical activity. Now, I will say,
sport
though,
on the TV stays on the TV.
Yeah, well, people have good intentions, but psychologists know that doesn't really mean much.
Scrolling on the phone doesn't quite break a sweat. Writer Malcolm the Tipping Point Gladwell was the guest on Second Captains. He's a runner, rather a good one, and even better if you'd met him as a teenager.
I peaked at the age of 15. It seems so absurd to say, with respect.
The story is for quite a few people out there, I think, Malcolm. Many of our best sporting highlights are 14 and under, 15 and under, probably.
Yes, I was at 14, I ran a 4:14, 1500 meters, and at 15, I ran a 4:05, 1500 meters, and at 1:58, half mile. And then my career just kind of faded away. I got injured. I stopped running, I got distracted, and I didn't race again until I was 50. I took a 35-year break. But I still followed the sport, but I didn't. In retrospect, it was the thing I regret most. I would love to have known what I could have run in my peak. I don't think I was going to be an elite runner, but I think it would have been a nice, comfortably sub-elite runner. And I would really like to have known whether I could have broken a 4 minute mile, for example, at 25, but I'll never know that. So, you know, there are runners that you know at an early age that you sense really are special. Mm. And there were those I ran with who I knew were better than me ultimately. So I was never under any false illusions about my ability. I was pretty good, and I'm, for my age, I'm still pretty good.
Ooh, just a tinge of middle age compromise and disappointment, which we will dress up as wisdom. But it was enough to score Malcolm Gladwell 88 points and the new lead for Second Captains. On Mooney Goes Wild, it was babbler time, and not just any babbler.
The Sulawesi babbler.
Babbler. And Fionn O'Markey from Trinity College has been studying the evolution of these birds in Indonesia.
One of the things that kind of turned us on to the Sulawesi babbler was noticing in the field that they sounded quite different in different places. Because they are a very vocal bird. They're skulking and shy in that they rarely come out of the undergrowth, but they do sing very prominently in the kind of the dawn chorus of Sulawesi. So as the team was going around different islands, we kind of thought, these ones do sound a little bit different, but how can we be systematic about that? There's a kind of an established methodology you use here, where you take recordings from different populations and you feed them into this program, where then you can measure the peak frequency of the song, other traits like that. So that's the frequency at which the signal is strongest, and then how long the song goes on for, how much the frequency changes over the course of it and things like that. And then that can give you a more objective answer of how different they are.
If it is identified as a subspecies, will it get a new name?
Yes, and species has a binomial name, and then the subspecies has the third part. So Pelornium celebense is the species, and this population was Pelornium celebense improbatum. It's a funny name because it means like dishonest. And then it had another name, Sordidum. So it was named as being kind of sordid and dirty and bad. But then they had to change that because there was already a different subspecies called Sordidum. So I don't know how offensive these babblers were that all these taxonomists were calling them sordid and dishonest and all the rest of it. But for whatever reason, they've ended up with quite insulting names.
Fionn O'Markey of Trinity College on the... You say it, Derek.
The Sulawesi babbler.
As heard on Mooney Goes Wild. And over on Arena Film Reviews with Donald Clark and Gemma Cray.
Donald, when I saw the setup for The Courier, and from what little I know of your taste, or what a fair bit I know about your taste in film, I thought, he liked this one on paper at any rate. Yeah, this is your era.
The phrase pushing out an open door did spring to mind whenever I learned what this is about. Yeah, I am a complete sucker for stories about kind of pathetic British people in the late 50s and early 60s and the Cold War, and put those two things together and you really are pushing out an open door with me. The shadowy corners, the Argyle jumpers and little cameras concealed in false drawers. This film pushed very, very gently at that door, it should be said, but just enough to allow me to squeeze in.
Now, The Courier stars Benedict Cumberbatch, and it also stars our own Jessie Buckley playing his wife. Not exactly the meatiest of roles, at least not initially.
Because for the first two-thirds, she has the most awful wife part. You know those wife parts. Why are you working all the time? Why are you shouting at little Andrew when we're on our awful holiday in a stupid tent? One of those parts, you know, that, that Anne Archer used to do in the 1980s and 1990s. And this is like one of the most talented actors of her generation. She finally does get to do something
later
in the
on.
Last third and justify her place in the film.
And Gemma, though, you notice the age disparity between Jessie Buckley and Benedict Cumberbatch when it came to the fact that they're a married couple with this young son. Hollywood, how are you?
Yeah, well, that's exactly the point. Donald, you said this when, and how can they cast a young woman in her 20s as a CIA agent, is because they only cast young women in their 20s for every single role. For the wife of a 50-something year old. It's a go-to thing, and it's not the only one in the films that we are watching today either. The exact same thing happens with Ryan Reynolds and Jodie Comer. So she's a good 16 years younger than him as his romantic interest in the other film. So it's just something that is, it just needs to be acknowledged. And don't get me wrong, they're a good pair. They have a good on-set chemistry as a couple, Cumberbatch and the fabulous Jessie Buckley. Like she could act her way out of anything. But again, a lot of her acting is internal, because as Donald made a very good point, her character was not written given a lot.
So with open doors and romantic age gaps, how did all of this translate into stars?
A middling three.
A middling three. And what are you saying overall, Gemma?
3.5.
Ooh, so-so and so-so and a wee little bit for The Courier. And what about three men in a boat rowing across the Atlantic? Enough to get on your nerves? Not a bit of it, says Ray Byrne. And by the way, he's phoning Catherine from the middle of the ocean.
How have you been getting on in the smallest of environments, in the biggest of swells, with, you know, all of these problems, a lack of water? How have you been getting on, and how have you been staying sane? And have there been frayed tempers?
No frayed tempers. A jet plane just flew right.
Wow.
And it was like, I would say, 40 foot above the boat. That was kind of crazy. No frayed tempers. We're definitely all in it together, you know. You're sharing kind of all of the burden together as it goes on. And, like, the highs and lows of this thing have just been, like, we've thought we were going home twice. Once after the big breakdown, and then after the water maker. And, like, when we fix the water maker, you're so ecstatic, and you're sharing it with the other two men here, that it's like, you only have to look back at, I felt a little tired the other day, and looking back at how bad I felt when I thought this whole thing would be taken away from me, I just started laughing, you know? And we've just been in great form. I mean, anyone who looks at our Instagram, people give out to us on Instagram because we're having too much fun. Because we're like, it's too much shenanigans, they said. So we're posting these like fun videos and everything. And I don't know. We're having a good time.
You're having a good time.
And if it was fun times on Insta out in the Atlantic, it was a case of Twitter and scraps when John Boyne came into Ryan to talk about his new book, The Echo Chamber.
Some might misconstrue it as being a sort of anti-cancel culture, which or anti, not anti-woke, but certainly anti-overcorrection.
Yeah. Okay, well, two things I'd say about that. Firstly, it is anti-cancel culture. I think the idea that a person can be cancelled, like a television programme or a train schedule, is obscene. You know, that we can just decide that a person, that their value system, no matter what it is, whether it's in line with yours or the opposite of yours, is so morally offensive to you that person should not be allowed to work, to live, or to express opinions. So I think anybody who subscribes to the idea of cancel culture, I think it's obscene. when it comes to wokeness, I think we have to remember that woke should not be a pejorative. It's become a pejorative, yes. But it shouldn't be. The idea of wokeness at the start was an equalizing of society, raising up voices that had been historically disenfranchised and having a level playing field for everybody. And now it seems to me the right use the word woke as an insult against anything. You know, if you say, oh, I like this book by maybe somebody who is part of a traditional minority, you'll be told, oh, you're so woke. When actually it's good to be woke. Yeah. Now, I know I mock these things a lot in the book, but what I'm mocking is the people who use it to just want the world to think that they are so perfect, that they are paragons of virtue. We are none of us paragons of virtue. And using social media in that way to sort of constantly, you know, just do it in real life. Help people do good in real life. You don't have to actually tell the world you're doing the good deeds.
And on Bowman on Sunday, how to compose a score for the Gaelin film Misha Era. Sean O'Riordan set out the challenges, and he too risked antagonising people.
In this film, dealing as it does with such a subject, the Irish struggle for liberation, and seeing that we're all Irishmen in this country, it was very difficult without making one's nationalism
stand out too much. Yes.
Because that, to a certain extent, may antagonize some people. And it isn't that one dreads antagonizing some people, but that it tends to overbalance the film if you do assert your nationalism too strongly. However, being Irish, it was impossible without taking some stand on the thing.
Suitably dramatic waves crashing against the rocks for the week that was in it. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.